This is HPR episode 1860 entitled, 5150 Interviews Chris Wade on Save Wi-Fi. It is hosted by 5150 and is about 137 minutes long. The summary is, this could be the most important podcast you listen to this year.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Howdy, folks. This is 5150 for Hacker Public Radio. I'm here tonight with Chris Wade, the CEO of Think Penguin, and also someone who's been instrumental in the Save Wi-Fi movement. And I really think if you're not already familiar with this issue, this may be the most important podcast that you've listened to this year. So, Chris, I'll let you start off and explain the Save Wi-Fi movement and why it's necessary.
Okay, so Save Wi-Fi is a reaction to rule changes that the FCC is passing and proposing. There's rules that have already passed, and then there's rules that are being proposed. Right now, we're fighting the rules that are being proposed because those rules will be able to hopefully curtail them from ever getting passed. The rules that have passed, we're going to have to go back and fight one way or another at a later date. So basically, what the FCC is, it's the Federal Communications Commission, and they basically certify hardware devices. So things like computers and wireless routers and cell phones and basically any kind of electronic device. These devices have firmware on them or operating systems. And they also have pretty much all electronics these days have some sort of wireless chip. And these wireless chips are... They use the airwaves, and that makes it the FCC's territory as far as regulating them. This is usually a good thing because if everybody was just using whatever frequencies they wanted to, nobody would be able to understand each other. The best example I can give is if you ever listen to a radio station, and you're hearing the radio station you're currently listening to or trying to listen to, and you're also hearing another radio station, you can get an idea what's going on. So you're hearing two different radio stations at the same time, and that's because they're not sticking to their spectrum. They're a little part of the spectrum. So the same thing happens with wireless devices and other types of radio equipment and so on. What currently appears to be happening is the FCC is reacting to basically that interference, and they're doing it in a way that is going to result in manufacturers locking down basically any kind of device that has a modern wireless chip in it. So it has to do with what's it have to do with exactly? It's software-defined radio. And basically what software-defined radio is is it's a radio that can be used for multiple things. And your computer software controls it, or your wireless router software, your firmware, that controls the radio directly, as opposed to it being defined or controlled by or having some other limitation by the radio, basically the radio itself. So any user, as a result of this, any user can, if the user is able to replace the firmware anyway, on say like a wireless router, then they can cause interference on spectrums that part of the spectrum that is not they're not allowed to, that the router manufacturer has not been certified for, has not been authorized to use, and in that part you're not allowed to do it either. There may be certain circumstances where it is allowed. If you are, for example, a ham radio operator, then you are licensed to do more than what the original equipment might be. You know, you might be permitted to otherwise do with the equipment usually, but as a normal user, you wouldn't be able to go beyond certain parameters. So what was going on, or it appears, the FCC hasn't exactly come out and said in any kind of clear statements that I've been able to identify, nor has anybody else that has come into this discussion. There have been people who have made statements of facts, but it appears to have been nothing other than speculation or reading of other information that was said by others, and then they basically just stated as fact. Basically, what's been said that is still speculation is that the FCC is reacting to radio or weather Doppler interference with weather Doppler systems around airports. That has definitely happened, but we don't know whether or not that's they're reacting to that particular incident. They have definitely fined companies, which is within their authority to do so.
I think I'm dropping packets like a madman, and so Mumble's kicking me out like every 3 minutes, so I'm missing about half what Chris says. But fortunately, he's the one recording, so if I ask him a question and it seems like, where were you a minute ago when he answered that already, that's why. I'm still here, Chris. As a PC manufacturer, I guess one of the things we're really worried about is this is going to be applied to PCs and routers, consumer routers, because it could construe that the Wi-Fi chips that are going into PCs going forward are software-defined radio, especially if the FCC's definition that if you can get to the chip and change the power or anything, then it's a software-defined radio. So as a manufacturer, you looking ahead, you're not going to be able to buy motherboards that don't have, for laptops, that don't have something that looks like a software-defined radio for the FCC.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to start talking now. basically, it's any device that has a software-defined radio, and every modern Wi-Fi chip is basically a software-defined radio. They haven't actually, the lawyers who looked through this and are more knowledgeable than I, as well as some of the software developers who are working on the working as part of the Safe Wi-Fi Coalition, have basically said they haven't actually defined software-defined radio, but all modern devices in some way are a software-defined radio. Are software-defined radios, all the Wi-Fi chips out there. Point to some very good examples of that. We have 802.11n USB Wi-Fi adapters in our catalog, and the source code's been released for these for the chipsets. There's two chipsets. It's ATH9K-HTC, and Adrian and Lewis and Think Penguin, and between the three of us, mostly got Qualcomm, and Adrian and Lewis worked for, they used to work for Qualcomm Athros, and together we basically got Qualcomm Athros to really to cooperate on releasing the source code, and these the firmware is it runs on these adapters, these USB adapters, and we have two particular three different USB adapters, two different chipsets that are part of ATH9K HTC that we use in our products, and these would be software defined radios. So this is a perfect example. I'm really not entirely sure how they would prevent a user from. Well, I guess the way they would prevent a user. I guess what you'd have to do is you'd have to change the Wi-Fi, like if it was a USB Wi-Fi adapter, you'd have to implement proprietary, well, the firmware actually is loaded on, is actually part of the operating system, and then gets uploaded to the USB chip, Wi-Fi chip. But I guess they would have to put a, I'm not really sure how you would put a lock on there, maybe a hardware lock, I don't know, it doesn't actually say. So normally, I would assume that companies would implement these locks in software. It doesn't appear that the FCC is requiring them to put in any kind of lock in hardware. What they've actually asked more specifically of manufacturers is how they're going to prevent the loading of third-party firmware, and then they use DDWRT as an example, which explicitly implies that there's going to be some sort of, you know, there's going to be some sort of signature checking. I'm thinking this was related to routers, but it could be, you know, again, it's not specific. The regulations aren't specific to wireless routers. So you would also, therefore, you would have to jump into the problem of this also being applied to laptops and other devices. The issue itself kind of has snuck in on us because there's already rules, again, that have passed that are already a major problem. We've already seen router manufacturers updating their firmware to add these software locks. Libri CMC is a distribution that runs on one of our routers. It's 100% free distribution that we sponsor and work on. And Bob Cole is the lead developer for that distribution. And the routers, now he mostly tries to focus on the router that we, a particular router that we sell, but at ThinkPenguin. But he also does support other, there's also other routers that are supported, or you can at least run Libri CMC on. And during his testing, when we get in these other routers and we get newer versions of these routers, the routers are the same, in many cases, and the boards will, the only difference will be updated firmware on the board. And so he's already seen these locks, and you know, he's talking to me all the time about it, about how, you know, there's all these companies and they're all adding locks to their firmwares now, and now we realize why they're doing that. It's actually kind of humorous because one of the largest manufacturers of routers on the market, we've actually been told that they, and my understanding was they were talking to the CEO, and at the head of the at the top of the company, they're not even aware of the issue, which, you know, probably isn't really too surprising. But they're concerned because they're big on, I guess they're big in concern about making sure that their customers as well can, you know, flash whatever firmware they'd like onto the router. So it's quite interesting. Now at the lower levels, which I would imagine are, you know, engineering levels, they basically just implemented. I guess they've just implemented these locks because we're already seeing them, and these rules are already some of these rules are already in effect now. I'm not sure exactly what the dates were for the new rules, but nonetheless, so there's already problems, and the rules that we want people to, or we're trying to get curtailed now, are a set of proposed rules, and those rules basically, there's what's called a open comment period, and the FCC is required to take feedback on any rule changes. This is the opportunity for users and manufacturers and anybody, any organization that wants to submit feedback to the FCC on these rule changes can do so. So what we've done is we've gone and created a page, a website at www.savewifi.org that explains, there's a lot more actually on the website than this, but basically is very nice, simple instructions on how to file comments with the FCC. It gives you some instructions on how to do it, the different types of issues that you might run into yourself. You know, so some just examples, some sample comments, kind of thing. We're also working on, more of a letter, also. So it'll be even easier, hopefully, in the near future, to comment with the FCC. Let's see. So going back to, computers and how it might impact us. We don't entirely know all the details yet. These devices are a typical computer right now is manufactured with a separate chip, but there's it really depends on a number of different factors. A lot of these newer systems, not the ones that really are on the market right now. Well, some of them that are on the market right now, like for example, a lot of the Chromebooks, these all have what's called a system on a chip, and they've got integrated Wi-Fi, and it's basically a software-defined radio, and it can be controlled by the main OS. So those types of systems would basically have to be locked down. That is the cheapest way to do it anyway. It's the easiest, quickest way to do it. And that's what's happening in practice. Let's put it that way. There could potentially be other ways to deal with this problem. But the FCC has already gone out and made the assumption that the only way, and again, this is because this is the cheapest way, so this is the way everybody's going to do it, is to lock the devices down. So presumably, short of, and the FCC can't go and say, they can't really tell a manufacturer how to lock a device down, or how to stop the parameter changes. So I'm not entirely, there's been some people who have said, oh, well, they only care about, you know, that you're not violating the spectrum, or the users aren't allowed to violate the spectrum. Well, that may be true. But if the end result is that manufacturers are going to lock the devices down because they have to be competitive and they need to do stuff the quickest and cheapest way possible, which they pretty much all do. Nobody's really, as far as I understand, nobody's contributing significant amounts of resources to developing router software. I'm talking specifically in the case of routers at the moment. So a lot of the improvements that we get with networking and routing devices and similar are actually coming out of the fact that the sources are available. And if the sources aren't available, basically all innovation is going to stop. It's going to come to a screeching halt. One of the issues that I've liked to give as an example of this is buffer bloat. So basically, this is a really great example. Recently, there's been support added for this, and it's been tested on a fork of OpenWRT. And basically, what this does is it's basically algorithms that better manage network traffic, I guess. Basically, the end result is the low, ultra low latency. Nothing like we've seen before. It's so much better. And what that basically means is there's something called bandwidth and there's something called latency. And bandwidth is basically how much data can come over the pipe. Latency is how quickly you'll get a response, basically. So if the latency goes down, your download isn't going to get done any quicker. But if you visit a web page, you're going to get a much quicker response. That page is going to show up much quicker on your screen. So this is a really huge thing. Every end user is going to notice this huge increase in basically performance. I would probably call it almost like performance, at least from the end user's perspective, your typical end user's perspective. And it didn't require, you know, a faster connection. What it required was this innovation in software. So we wouldn't have that if it wasn't for and the guy actually who was, I believe, the main person behind this buffer bloat fix, basically. And again, it's not really a fix. It's more of more of an innovation than an actual like bug that was fixed in this particular case. He's actually one of the people who's also been working with the Save Wi-Fi campaign and trying to write up a nice template letter to try and explain and document in detail exactly why it's so important that we have access to the source. Well, we don't have the locks, is more specifically what he's talking about, and that we continue to have access to the source code and how this is actually significantly advanced networking in GNU Linux and any operating system that's using any distribution that's using the Linux kernel. So it is something that this fix didn't just impact routers. It impacted laptops. It impacted billions of devices. These innovations, these improvements, they'll show up in OpenWRT. They'll show up in LibreCMC, third party firmware. But eventually, they make it back to the mainline Linux kernel, and that ends up shipping with billions of devices. So this isn't just a hacker issue. This isn't just for hackers. This is for everybody. Your mom is going to see an improvement in the response time of her, you know, her Facebook posts or whatever website she's using, her email, her email messages will pop up quicker. There's other great examples of improvements as well, and not so much at this level, but a different part of the stack, the software stack. The one I like to use, because I also this is one that I have a more personal or more closer relationship to, as far as software and development improvements go. I wasn't actually involved in the fix so much as through the code. But going back to what I was talking about originally was the ATH9K HTC firmware that we got released. Now ThinkPenguin and Adrian and Lewis had nothing to do with this. This was a bug that affected a lot of users who were using the AR9271 chipset that this firmware supports. And basically, the problem wasn't really with the chipset. It was really with the computers that these devices, these USB Wi-Fi devices, were being plugged into. And these devices had a problem with the packet size, and we're talking about basically like a USB packet, and so these controllers, the USB controllers on these systems, wouldn't handle larger packet sizes. They'd fail. Maybe it would work initially, but you'd run into all different problems with all different types of devices that would plug into if the device, the USB adapters that you were using, were using a bigger packet size. So this there was a person who went out and he hunted down what the problem was and he fixed it. And lo and behold, we were actually investigating the issue around the same time, and we came across this fix, and we were like, "This is awesome!" So we tested it, and we built it. We built the sources. We applied. It was literally, I think it was one line. I wouldn't even call it like a fix, really. It was literally just. I think it was just the change of the packet size. So it was like maybe two numbers, something like that. Anyway, so he changed it. We built the source code, we built the firmware again, and we're like, okay, let's test this. And we tested it and it worked great. Then we started, distributing it to our customers, and lots of people were really, really happy when they got it. You know, they expected it to work, and then it, the adapters didn't, but then we had a solution for them, which is great. And eventually, this firmware will make it back into the mainline kernel, and you will have, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of users will be impacted by this improvement, but it's going to be significant because you have to understand chipsets are designed. There's not too many companies designing chipsets, so there might be four or five, six maybe at the most probably that are designing Wi-Fi chipsets, and that number is actually shrinking. So there's probably only like a really small handful today. For like the most recent Wi-Fi chips, I think there's probably only like, I don't know, maybe four or five, maybe. Anyway, so all these chips are being used in different devices. And that means that you're going to run into the same problems no matter which of these USB devices you have. So this isn't just impacting our customers. This is impacting, hundreds of thousands, maybe billions of customers. I calculated there's 500,000 USB Wi-Fi adapters a year sold for just to people running GNU Linux. There's definitely, and if you figure, if you take that number and you divide it by 1/4, that's 100,000 maybe. I mean, again, really rough guesstimating here, but if there's 100,000 people a year, and I don't know how long, and I don't know how many years these chipsets were used, but if they were used for, 4 or 5 years, maybe, that's, 400,000 or 500,000 people. And then you would have to figure that even if, even if it's 5% of users, we'll say, I mean, it could be significantly more, I'm not really sure. But even 5% of that number is a pretty large number. Yeah, it's really important. It might not have been a large enough number to actually make any manufacturer or company designing these chipsets look into the problem, but it certainly was affecting a lot of people. A lot of people in the scheme of the overall number, not so much it's not so much that there was a lot of people as a percentage, because it probably wasn't really that many as a percentage, but in terms of just raw numbers, it was definitely a huge, huge number. When you have these bugs and nobody else is experiencing them, those bugs probably will never get fixed unless the sources are available and end users can go, developers, on their free, in their free time and hunt down the bugs and fix the bugs and produce third-party firmware. Is it going to end up, those fixes are going to make it back into, onto the billions of devices that are sold I don't want to say every year, but onto the billions of the devices that are sold, because they end up, those bug fixes end up going back into the mainline. Usually it's the mainline kernel if it's a case of like a kernel, like a driver type for hardware. This isn't necessarily there's also other types of, it's important to have free software, not just at the, kernel and the firmware level, but it's also important to have it at the, application level as well. So the applications are running on your desktop or your phone. Because if you don't have the sources, then, people can't go and fix the bugs. And you don't have that a community that can develop behind it. I don't know if you're there still, but if you have any questions.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, if you have any questions, it might be a good time to ask. Otherwise, I might go into some of the other interesting stuff in regards to this campaign.
Yeah, I'm back on 3G now, so it's, at least I'm not disappearing every minute. I told you earlier today via email that I'd been contacted today, also via email by Josh Gay from the FSF, and he's in their licensing department. And he reiterated some of the things you said about we're already seeing some of the routers, if you download the OEM firmware, all of a sudden it changes the router, so only certified firmware can be loaded. So you have some routers that you could load DDWRT on yesterday, so to speak, and now you upload the newest factory firmware, and you're locked out of putting on third-party firmware. So this stuff can go back to routers on the shelves now, but who knows how far back they're going to take this.
The FCC is actually requiring the recertification of devices. So that's why you're seeing that. It's not just because they're shipping new firmware on new devices, but they're actually the boards, the routers that they designed, 3 years ago, if they're still selling them and they want to continue to sell them, they have to get them recertified, which means they have to ship them now with updated firmware. And legally they can't even market them, from my understanding anyway.
And I broke my train of thought, but the other thing that he talked about, he had gotten some communication or at least some analysis on these documents and was pretty sure that the FCC is going to define software-defined radio as, even DDWRT, let's face it, it was, and the other open source firmwares were marketed as, hey, it's the same, Europe and Asia, they broadcast a slightly higher power than what we're allowed to hear. So if you replace the firmware with open source, we can bump the power a little bit for you. And according to Josh, that matches the definition of software-defined radio in their eyes.
Yeah, software-defined radio isn't clearly defined by the FCC, in the FCC rules, from my understanding. Basically, the EFF, I believe it was an EFF lawyer. Was it the EFF lawyer? So there's a few different lawyers who are looking at this code, or I'm sorry, not the code, the rule changes, and they basically said something to the effect of that it's not really clearly defined the what software-defined radio is even, but it's probably pretty safe to assume that if it's not defined, they're gonna interpret it very, very broadly. And if they do, then basically everything is a software-defined radio. Any of the modern Wi-Fi cards, because they're all software-defined radios. At least in some part. There's a 5 gigahertz issue. I'm trying to think like what exactly here I wanted to say, but basically there's an issue with 5 gigahertz specifically, as far as, so 5 gigahertz, basically that spectrum is generally for, I think the term is unlicensed use basically. It doesn't mean that your device doesn't have to be certified. It just means that basically anybody can use it. But the device still has to be certified. And there's a little part of this spectrum that is not, that you're not allowed to use. Unless you use this piece of code, and what it does is it listens around airports. And if it detects that there's something, there's this thing called Doppler radar, and it's for weather. And if it detects this in use, then it won't use that part of the spectrum. It used to be that wasn't, you weren't allowed to use that at all. But because of the rule changes, now you can, as long as you comply with certain rules as far as checking to make sure that you're not around an airport, basically. None of these other systems are in place. So that's part of actually the reason why we're running into this problem, is because they've changed the rules for the better, but now they're concerned about how it's going to and how it's impacting. Or again, this is actually speculation. This part, I want to make that clear, because there's a lot of people out there saying this is like, basically they're saying they're making it as a statement, and it comes off as being factual, and it's not that does not appear to be the case from anybody who has looked into this. So if somebody has a statement from the FCC, you know, stating that the rules are in relation or a reaction to the Doppler radar cases, you know, send us an email because I'd love to hear it. Because the FCC has been when we've asked the FCC or and others have asked the FCC has kind of double speak, something like that. And basically, what I'm saying is they say one thing, and then if you read into it, the actual result of what they're saying is that everything's gonna have to be locked down. They'll say that we're not requiring, you know, devices to be locked down or something to that effect, but then they say you have to comply with these rules, and the only way that manufacturers can really comply with them is to lock the routers down. So it's really kind of humorous. There might be some other ways to comply with the rules possibly, but you know, there's a whole bunch of like clarification like the FCC would have to do, and like what exactly is acceptable, I guess is what it comes down to. And if you actually look at their what they're actually asking manufacturers during the certification process, the question explicitly asks them, what are they doing to prevent loading of third-party firmware such as DDWRT? That's almost an exact quote there. So it's really, really scary. They've already made the assumption that the only way that a company can even come into compliance with these rules is by locking down the devices, which is a very fair assessment of the real world situation that we're in right now, and because of, again, also the results of what we're actually seeing here at Think Penguin with Liberty CMC and the routers that we're looking at and we're testing and we're seeing these firmware changes, purely firmware changes. So it's a big issue. And these routers, that's what we're seeing it with, more specifically, but, in theory, it should apply to, you know, pretty much anything, with a software defined radio in it. I should be careful. Anything with a software defined, a modern, Wi-Fi chip, that's using a software defined radio. It's possible that it maybe won't complete. It won't be necessary. I'm not one of the engineers. I have a computer science background, but I'm not one of the engineers. Lewis and Adrian would probably be able to better respond to some of these questions or clarify some of this. But I believe that you might be okay if it's in like an 802.11n 2.4 gigahertz card. I'm not entirely sure if those actually require recertification or not, but anything with, like, I guess basically on the 5 gigahertz spectrum would require recertification. There's also some other things that, you know, people should be aware of. The rules, there's different sets of rules, and I'm not talking about the specific set of proposed rules, even. I'm talking more broadly about what's going on. The proposed rules, though, are a problem, and regardless, you can go to www.savewifi.org, and you can read up on the details. The page that it'll direct you to is going to be basically more a non-technical, explanation of the problem, but you can actually go on and you can read much, much more in depth, as far as, you know, what the rules actually say specifically. And, if you get on the archive, the mailing list archives for Save Wi-Fi, that has been set up, you can also actually go back and read all of the same stuff I'm spouting off here. And you can see, oh, it was an EFF lawyer, or, you know, you can see it was Free Software conservancy lawyer, or you can see, you know, that it was Adrian that said something, or Lewis that said something. Those are two software developers that used to work at Qualcomm. Or you can see, the Free Software Foundation, Josh, he's done a lot to work on figuring out exactly what everything is, what exactly the situation is, and we've all been following. I've been following along a lot, but I've also done more of the publicity, trying to explain to people how this is going to impact them. So anyway, he's been doing more of the. Okay, how is this going to impact us? What do we need to say? How are we going to, fight this? I've been looking at it more from an angle of, okay, well, I'm seeing this actually impacting us in the real world. So it's quite an interesting group of people who have been, I'd say there's probably about a dozen, maybe a dozen people who have really been following for about a month before this campaign even started, just working on figuring out exactly what the details are, trying to get, clarification from FCC. And there's a lot of misinformation and errors that are floating about, both because the FCC has extended the deadline because of basically their servers where they were taking it down right in the middle of the open comment period, and they extended it all of it's I guess there's different rules, sets of rules that are basically up for like review, or there might be, and they're all basically were extended until October 9th, I believe it was. And then if they were ending during that comment period, during that server downtime, but because of the work we did, the FCC, in requesting an extension, the FCC, well, they did extend the comment period so people can comment. So there's, it was about a month that they extended it. So it's October now. So you don't want to wait. That's the one thing you don't want to do. You don't want to wait. Spend some time, reviewing it. How is this going to impact you? And send your comments into the FCC. The more information that you have, the better your comment is. Let me rephrase this. The citing specific instances is better than just sending in a comment that says, oh, this is going to affect me because I use OpenWRT or something like that. That's not as useful. It's not to say it's not useful, especially because there are there's something that the FCC is required to do, and it's something It's basically they're supposed to do an evaluation of the impact that any rule changes are going to have, and they've basically kind of written it off. And they basically said that, oh, this isn't going to have any impact. Well, that's not really true. So the more people who basically speak up, it should show in theory, if it ends up in a court or something, that. Hey, wait a minute, there really are a lot of people who are affected, and they didn't really do the analysis properly, or something to that effect. But again, the ones that the FCC is really going to be looking at, it would probably be a court of law that actually looked at the fact that they didn't do the analysis properly or something to that effect, not the FCC. But we don't want it to come down to that, of course, because a law, if you actually have to take something to court, it's a heck of a lot harder to do and much more expensive. And, who knows if we could even come up with the funds to do that, or, so on. So, yeah, you need to send in good comments, the best comments you can. Look up, see what impact it'll have, on you. And, if you're a company that sells, routers with, third party firmware, and you're downstream of, the actual manufacturer, and you might not be selling 100,000 units a year. You might just be selling, maybe a couple thousand units a year. How is this going to affect you? Maybe you sell Wi-Fi. You use a third-party firmware to sell internet access to your customers, or maybe you use it as a Just as a maybe you're in a shop that has free Wi-Fi access, how is that going to impact you? If you can't load third-party firmware anymore, you won't be able to provide your customers free internet access. At least you won't be able, well. I'm not sure if you quite go that far, but I think people get the idea that it will prevent things. For example, here's a good example of what I'm talking about. So there are components within third-party firmwares that can be enabled, and I'm sure many people have seen this, where you go into a McDonald's or you go into any kind of cafe. When you get on the Wi-Fi, it comes up with a message saying, terms and conditions, and basically says you won't do anything illegal, and you click accept. I accept, right? Well, those conditions are provided by a component that isn't going to be in your off the shelf, generally speaking, anyway, off the shelf factory firmware. That's something that has probably been added by, maybe even if you did get that as a feature with the router, it probably was added by somebody, some company, some smaller company that is a downstream of the major manufacturer. They wouldn't be allowed to do that anymore. They wouldn't be allowed to be able to sell that product, because it would have to be certified, and then it would have to be. They would definitely have to have it certified. They'd have to have the firmware signed. All of this stuff is very important. And again, the firmware signing has to do with the fact that if you want to comply basically with the rules so that end user can't control it, the only thing that you can flash are versions of the firmware without the features that would enable you to use the radio in an unauthorized way. So there's actually some people are saying things like, oh, it doesn't really matter because I'm just going to hack around it. Well, yeah, this is actually true. You can actually hack around this stuff right now because these locks are not, it's not mandated that these locks basically or any of the signature checking be done in hardware. So it's actually kind of humorous because it easily means that the FCC won't really gain anything from doing this. Anybody who intentionally goes out of the way, and this is not something you can easily do anyway, because the firmwares that are causing the problems are by commercial entities which have already been fined, or at least it appears to be. This is more speculation as far as this is why they're doing it. So I don't know that with certainty, and people who are saying otherwise are basically don't know what they're talking about. They're basically just citing speculation as fact. It's being done at a software level, and that will comply. But you can get $100 worth of specialized equipment, and you can flash the chips directly. And when you do this, you would be breaking the law. You'd be breaking the rules, the FCC rules. And as an end user, you can actually be fined up to $20,000 if they catch you. So as well as manufacturers. So it's really important that we change these rules. We get them overturned. And the proposed rules, for that matter, we get them curtailed so that they don't go into effect at all. What's really scary though is actually there's actually two things. One. The one is that they right now, this is a software thing, but what's to stop the FCC from going and saying they have to adopt Intel's technology, which basically it's a hardware lock, and this is already in all modern Intel CPUs, and I believe there might be something in AMD, but yeah, I know AMD is also a problem in any event. Let's put it this way. But basically, what this technology wasn't designed. This is an interesting tidbit from being talking to all the different engineers and people. But basically, the technology is not designed. Intel's technology for locking and signature checking and hardware is not specific to x86 chips. It can actually be used on other platforms. So there's nothing to stop the FCC from coming in tomorrow and saying, oh, well, we can get around this. So you got to do this in hardware now. And that's the scary thing. If it's done in hardware, you're not going to be able to, you know, just get $100 worth of specialized equipment and flash a trip directly, because you could, I mean, you could do that, but it's not going to work, because if it's not at a hardware level, then all of a sudden, when you boot the device after you flashed it, it won't boot because it's checking a signature, and it's not going to be Intel's signature or Intel's key. It's not going to be signed with Intel's key, in other words. So it's just not going to boot. So, you know, they can go to that extreme and do that. And that's really the only way that this would even really have the impact that the FCC wants or is attempting to get from having this level of control. But there's actually some more interesting, perspectives you can take this look at it from. And one is security, but people really don't understand that it's not just source code, like and being able to test and modify the source code and being able to flash their devices that is going to lead to security improvements and fixes that you won't otherwise get. I mean, we all know that manufacturers are horrible when it comes to security and providing updated firmwares and things like that to fix bugs. And those bugs are often, they're not fixed by manufacturers, they're fixed by somebody else, and the manufacturers integrate the patch. And when and if there's a lot of negative publicity about it, and that's the extent of it usually. But what's scary is there's only a handful of companies that are really manufacturing or designing pretty much any type of device. If you end up with a situation where the only people who can, sign these firmwares are basically the manufacturers, the original manufacturers, then you're in a situation where it becomes much, much easier to add back doors and things of that nature. Now, you might say, oh, that's paranoia. Okay, you're right. It might be a little bit of paranoia, but the problem is we've already seen, the NSA weaken encryption algorithms, or at least try to. We already know that there's multiple governments that are, it's not just, and it's not just governments, but there's multiple different criminal organizations and corporations for that matter that have certain interests in having these back doors. So you this could really become a really serious issue. We already know the NSA has been because of, I believe it was a Snowden leaks, we already know that NSA is installing backdoors in routers. We already know this. So this isn't that part of it. It's not really speculation. And we already know the NSA is weakened, weakened algorithms that were made the attempt to. And I guess they've actually got it implemented too, from my understanding. Not across the board, but in certain devices by RSA. I think it was RSA. So this is a really, really dangerous thing. I'm gonna repeat the website. It's www.savewifi.org. Our goal is to get people to send in comments to the FCC to tell them to stop with this effort to ban basically third-party firmwares. They're basically mandating locks, that manufacturers implement locks onto their firmware, so that you can't install third-party firmwares. www.savewifi.org. Make sure you do enter .org, because if you don't, you will get to a totally different site and be wondering what is going on. What else is there?
Well, one thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and I guess you said that you've been a guest recently on Linux for the Rest of Us, and I heard you a week ago on the Linux Link Tech Show. So, folks, if you're out there, you should definitely listen. Find those podcasts and listen to when Chris was on. Now, one thing that you brought up on the comments, you mentioned you mentioned something about you might be making it easier for people to comment. And the one thing that I've heard is we really don't want to send in copied boilerplate comments like, you know, the contact your congressman and you plug in your state and it finds your congressman and you plug in your email and the congressman gets 1,000 copies of the same statement. Apparently the FCC will ignore those. So you really need to do individualized comments.
Yeah. So like I was saying, it's definitely trying to individualize comments. We actually don't have a template letter. We're actually trying to work on one, but we obviously don't want people to send in a template, you know, a template letter. The reason that we want as many people to send in, tell the FCC that, you know, that they're affected is because the more people that comment, the better the argument is if it ever ends up in court. Because one of the problems is that the FCC hasn't really done a proper analysis as they're supposed to, as they're required to by law. They're not following their own rules. So that's really why we need as many people as possible to send in comments. But yeah, the comments really, if at all possible, try and cite examples, cite sources for your information. If you say, you know, it's going to cause a security issue, well, okay, can you cite an example of that security issue? Because if you don't, it's going to be more or less ignored by the FCC as 5150 is saying.
Now, I know that you've got NSF and the EFF on board and other organizations that typically we count on to bring these issues to our attention. Have you made any contacts in the from other hardware manufacturers? Well, not so much. Companies like Red Hat or Canonical, which are very invested in Linux on the desktop, and then other companies that internally use Linux like Google, Twitter, and Facebook.
Yeah, so we actually haven't really tried to reach out to any of these those particular types of entities. We've tried to focus more. Again, there's not enough people actually working on the campaign. So I've done most of the publicity for the campaign, which is really sad because I am not necessarily the best person. I don't have all the contacts that, you know, somebody who is, you know, does this for, you know, maybe, I don't know, a living or, you know, more of a marketing type of person might have. We are definitely in contact with like for example, we're in contact with one of the largest manufacturers of routers. And like I said, they haven't said anything publicly. Just to clarify this. I actually don't even know exactly who it was, which manufacturer, because it's again, like I said, I'm not the only one working on this campaign. There's a dozen other people, and the person, I don't even remember who it was who said that, but it was somebody who was who works in the industry. I believe, not like 99% confident. It was somebody who actually does like design, like engineering or something like that. Or maybe they might be a manager or something at like Qualcomm or some other similar company. But they're somebody in the industry is the impression that I from who it was. And this was all before let's see, I'm trying to think. Yeah, this was, I think, before it really got publicity. So it wasn't like some random person or anything like that. It was somebody who was I contacted specifically, or somebody that was added based on another person, credible information. Nothing got slipped in on us by accident here with that particular statement that somebody was working on. www.savewifi.org. Please go there, send the FCC comments. There's also a mailing list if anybody's interested. If you do get on the mailing list, please try not to send us like stuff that's like add too much garbage and fodder to the mailing list, because we're if you're actually going to get involved, like stuff like, oh, I contacted, you know, XYZ about, you know, the issue. Well, that's great. We want that. But if, you know, if you're going to, you know, have a discussion about, you know, sending 10 emails, about stuff that, oh, I don't know, I guess we've already, you know, we've already discussed, or, you know, you're going to argue about, you know, you want to argue about, you know, what the meaning of something is, or how, what approach we should take. That's not really, I kind of want to say it's not really welcomed. It's not really going to be useful, or, it's not going to really be helpful. I guess is the best way to put it. There's certain stuff that we're going to do, and it's going to be at a later date. Right now, we're really focused on, the proposed, rules and getting people to comment on those. We'll continue with this campaign much farther out. We're trying to get as much publicity this month as possible, and getting people sending in those comments. There's actually two different comments periods. There's the initial comment period, which is basically you have until basically the end of the month, maybe a little bit longer, but early October. The first comment period ends, and then there's going to be another comment period where people can send in responses, I guess, to other commenters or something that sounds like to me. So I'm not entirely sure of the details on that. But if you have some reason to ask more information, you can definitely ask on the mailing list. And again, that's all linked from the SaveWiFi.org site. Right now, SaveWiFi.org is linked to a Liberty Planet. Liberty Planet, for people who don't know, is basically it's a conference held by the Free Software Foundation every year, and the on free software, and they're basically providing the resources for the server and the wiki, and there's also the Purple Foundation, PRPL, that is hosting the mailing list. So yeah, there's a few different other groups in there that I also would like to, you know, just mention. People aren't familiar with them. Groups that people might want to look into just for, you know, just for the sake of, hey, these guys are doing a lot of work, and you know, it's always nice to hear, to be appreciated, I guess is what it comes down to.
Let me bring up my list of points. I had it right there in my mind. This is something I haven't heard anybody say on the topic, but let's face it, some people might out there might be saying, well, okay, I lose the use of Linux on my Wi-Fi laptop. I can still build a desktop and use it. But let's face it, industry is not going to build separate UEFI/BIOSes for laptops and desktops. So if you're buying a computer without Wi-Fi attached, you're still going to come under the same restrictions. And the other thing, I mean, it would be part, I would think, on the desktop, first you would have to have something that would keep you from installing something besides the OEM operating system, and then the both Apple and Microsoft would have to agree to put in something certification for any program that gets installed on their operating systems. In other words, you wouldn't be able to install anything that didn't come from their app store.
It's kind of funny. People think it won't affect desktops, but that's wrong.
Both those companies might welcome that.
They would. Microsoft and Apple certainly will. This is definitely going to affect desktops. I can already name a number of desktops that have integrated Wi-Fi. Most of the more recent miniature, smaller desktop computers. I'm not talking about things like the Raspberry Pi or Banana Pi or any of those. I'm talking about, I mean, those, yes, those would definitely be affected. But I'm talking about like Intel desktop systems. I'm talking about Intel with, you know, Intel i3 and Intel i5 CPUs. These systems are now shipping, most of them are shipping with integrated Wi-Fi. So I don't see any, I'm not really seeing, how that, again, these in theory, these rules should affect those systems as well. And even if the FCC like wasn't coming down on manufacturers yet, there's nothing with the rule change. There's nothing to stop them from coming down on manufacturers for that. And I'm also curious, what's to stop you from using like sticking in a USB Wi-Fi dongle? It just seems like even if it doesn't have Wi-Fi integrated, even if it doesn't have a mini PCIe card slot, or an M2 card slot, you know, where an internal Wi-Fi chip might usually go. I don't know. It seems like they could maybe even require. It gets complicated because the FCC doesn't actually, well, the FCC has they have authority over the rules, but as far as Wi-Fi is concerned, but they also certify devices that don't have Wi-Fi in them. So I'm not even entirely sure. I guess they can maybe they could even, you know, force it upon companies that don't have any Wi-Fi chips internally, or even slots for that matter for them. But again, it's I don't know. It's something that's kind of like we just don't know. We don't have enough information, and the FCC hasn't exactly, you know, been clear. They've kind of used doublespeak when people have asked them about these issues. So they, you know, they'll say one thing, and then if you actually think about it for a moment, if you understand what that means in practice, you'll realize it's doublespeak. If you don't understand what's going on behind the scenes, you might think, oh, it's not an issue. But unfortunately, people who should, I feel, should have known better, in particular, major publications have done written articles about it, have basically said stuff to the effect of, oh, it's being blown out of proportion by the Save Wi-Fi campaign. It's not. It's not blown out of proportion. Not by a long shot. The people you're quoting were not involved in the campaign. You might have gotten a quote from people that work at Qualcomm, or you might have gotten a quote from somebody who worked at the FCC. But if you don't understand what it is, the practical implications, not just what it, you know, the surface, you know, what's happening on the surface, but then yeah, you can definitely read into it saying it's not an issue, but it is. It is an issue, because if you look at what's going on in practice, in addition to other comments that certification stuff that manufacturers would have to do for certification, you'll realize that it's a major issue. See here, yeah. So by the way, some of these quotes that have been quoted by people at like Qualcomm, for example. Qualcomm, there's people at Qualcomm who are involved, and multiple ex-Qualcomm employees who actually worked on the firmware for the Wi-Fi chips. There's a lot of people that work at these companies, so just because you call up their their PR department or something and somebody says something doesn't necessarily mean it's reliable information. And that's basically what's going on. The people have basically at best, you know, maybe, you know, somebody from Qualcomm or, you know, some other organization is gone and they read a little bit of the Safe Wi-Fi campaign, but they didn't read enough into it to actually understand that we're not just talking about what the rules say, because what the rules say and how companies are basically going to have to react are two different things. Technically speaking, yeah, sure, maybe a company could come out, you know, some chipset, company that designs chipsets could come out with a product that complied with the rules. But you have to understand that there's only a few companies that are even designing chipsets, so, and they're all doing it in software. And they're not going to go back, because if they go back to the way they were doing it before, where it's in hardware, it's going to increase the cost, which is going to make their product uncompetitive, which means nobody's going to use it. You know, no company is going to implement that particular chipset. So it's not happening. It's the way it's going to end up going down is we're going to have software locks all over the place, and maybe hardware locks down the road if things keep going the way they're currently going, because we already know the technology exists. We've got confirmation that it's licensed. It's designed such where it could be licensed out. Intel's got the technology. Intel's got it such that it can be licensed out. If they so chose to. I don't know if they are licensing it out yet at this point, but why wouldn't they, right? If the FCC decides that this isn't good enough, which, you know, the software locks aren't, not really, then, you know, to solve the problem, then, but it will have a detrimental impact on users regardless. So, and as far as, actually, it's going to have a detrimental effect on users anyway, because, for example, with computers, now I'm thinking about the routers mostly, and that's where the software locks are clearly going to be used. But if you're talking about computers, they've already got the locks on them. And it's just a matter of flipping a bit, saying, okay, well, we're going to solve this problem by only allowing, Microsoft Windows to be installed on these systems. That's an easy bit to flip. It's probably the easiest bit to flip because it's already there. It's already in upstream reference designs that companies are, you know, using to build their products. I wouldn't be surprised if I haven't personally seen any laptops or desktops at this point which have had these bits flipped. We're also not. I'm gonna repeat where I'm coming from and how I'm coming looking at this from. I'm the CEO of Think Penguin. I think I said that, but nonetheless. We work on a router product, and we work on all sorts of products, but the most obvious clear examples that we're talking about here are the router and laptops and desktops. The laptops and desktops that we're currently selling are not I shouldn't quite say that. Let's see, I think they actually do have the locks. No, I'm sorry, they do actually have the locks. So now they're not enabled. I guess the best way to put it is they're not enabled in our products, but the locks are already. No, wait a minute. I'm sorry. There are locks in our products, actually, in our laptop products. So let's go back. There's something called Management Engine Firmware, and I hope I didn't just screw that up for like the dozenth time now. But basically, what this is it's a component of Intel CPUs, I guess, and basically, if you want 100% free software laptop, you can't get it today. You can get close to it with any basically all our products get as close as you can get to freedom, but with the laptops, we're basically being held hostage by Intel, and one of the in all of the newer Intel, and I'm talking about stuff from the last couple of years, not just the most recent Skylake or Broadwell stuff even, but they have this Intel firmware management engine, and this is basically a signed bit of a binary, and it's checked by hardware. And if you were to try and reverse engineer it, and you were to produce code for it, and you were to flash it onto this chip, that software wouldn't run because of this lock, the signature checking. This stuff is already in the products that we're buying, and it can easily be extended to other devices. And now in the case of this particular example, it affects the BIOS, but other parts of this, these systems, relating to UEFI and Secure Boot and similar systems, they're also already in our systems. So it is, while manufacturers may not be forcing you to use only Windows, they could easily do so. They could easily decide tomorrow with the flip of a switch, with 10 minutes worth of time and effort to change their firmware, that's no longer the case. And you would not be able to install, third party operating systems or third party firmwares, on your devices. You want to say anything, Bob?
Well, Well, like I said, my earlier thing was you'd also have to, and that I'm sure they would be happy to do it, you'd have to get Apple and Microsoft to lock down their operating systems where you could no longer install software that didn't have a certificate along with it, you know, so to keep somebody from writing some little program to access and change the parameters.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because I think we're already using, I think there's actually some, at least some or most systems already where you actually have to, so it's interesting because distributions are getting signed with a key by Microsoft. So we actually already are under, I want to say we're already under the grips of Microsoft, but I'm having somebody, Bob here, who's a developer for LibreCMC, is shaking his head. So there might be something slightly wrong. He often overreacts to some of the stuff that I say that's not quite 100% right, but, there's already issues, even if my statement wasn't quite right. So, and Bob, if you want to chime in here. I'm sure the people on the show would love to hear you. Nope, he's not. Okay. Well, I tried. So.
Well, like one thing you mentioned, I mean, I guess it could be possible your major distributions like Ubuntu, they could get certification, though I'm certain at some point they're going to mandate a code review. So only the people, the distributions with deep pockets, like say Fedora or Red Hat or Ubuntu would ever be able to pass that. So that would be the end of any boutique or derivative distributions. But what you'd have to do is lock down the distribution so that you couldn't install any software that's not in the repository, and you wouldn't be able to. As you mentioned on Tilt, you wouldn't be able to compile your own software.
I don't know. Like I said, I'm not really sure like how far they're you know. I mean, that seems like really hard for me to fathom. Like these rules are actually like extending that to this level of like control, but so here's the thing. I don't know. I'm not really sure how they. There's ways that you know you could potentially implement locking of parameter data to control the radio without actually locking down devices. And part of the problem is that companies aren't going to want to implement it, and the FCC can't mandate like how they go about doing this because it's beyond their authority. So ultimately, like, we're in a situation where, okay, they have to lock devices down, and that's the way they're going to do it because that's kind of the only way that it is going to work. So yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, you'd even be able to get short of more direct involvement with a particular manufacturer. I don't know that you'd even be able to get like Ubuntu, signed for a laptop. Like, I mean, we can probably deal with that problem. But like, if you were to try and install it on like an HP machine, for example, you probably wouldn't be able to do it because HP's not like, I mean, HP doesn't have any interests in, targeting like that particular part of the market. If they were interested, they would have already done it. Obviously they've got it on servers and things like that. So in those areas, they probably would, but I'm talking about like, you know, just their regular desktops and laptops. Maybe Dell would do it, because they do have, a system or two. I don't know. They'll just get out of the market, you know, they think it's too much trouble. I don't know. I can tell you right now that there's not a significant, there's one of the problems, with running a company, and selling to the market is that there's a lot of people running Linux and GNU and free software, but very few people are actually buying hardware specifically for it unless they're forced to. And that's a problem because it doesn't give companies incentives to properly support devices. And people kind of have this perception that, you can go out and buy anything and install Ubuntu and it's just going to work. And it's not really true, but nonetheless, People have this perception, and at the end of the day, we have people doing that in practice. So, you know, things won't work right and so on, but you know, they kind of, you know, they mess about and whatever. Maybe they'll get a Wi-Fi card to replace whatever's internally that doesn't work with Ubuntu or whatever. But again, at the end of the day, you know, if you're buying systems from, you know, HP or Dell or whoever, who don't really cater to the market, I mean, they might do it for publicity reasons, like Dell, for example. But they're not, they really don't care. They're obviously not doing it for money, because the money, they're not making enough money off of it. So, yeah, I mean, it's a scary situation. Their most likely scenario is that companies will just lock stuff down, because they have no interest in selling you a Windows upgrade. Even if they did, they can sign that. So if they sign it, then, you know, they're gonna make money off it. But they're not gonna make money off of selling you Ubuntu, because they're not selling Ubuntu. Are you sure you don't want to get in on the conversation here? Just say hi.
Well, while you're asking, I. The one bright spot I've seen, and it's not well enough documented,
yeah,
for my taste, is that Ars Technica article that I sent you earlier this week. And essentially, it's talking, like you said, you know, FCC is making the rules, and you know, if open source gets banned as an unintended consequence, you know, they're just going to throw up their hands. I mean, there's a couple places in this article that it implies that the FCC on the router side, that, you know, they're saying this is not what we intended for you guys to just chuck out open source entirely. We would like you to be responsible and put radios in these things that can't be, you know, can't be affected by software. That would be, you know, that it seems like, and I'll put this in the show notes, folks, but there's a couple big bold headings. One's unintended consequences, and the other one is FCC : open sourced won't be banned.
Yeah, it's,
and that, you know, that
some of these articles really, it's almost like somebody has an intent to undermine the campaign. I'm just amazed, because if you actually read the article, and that one specifically, I believe that you're referring to, it even says, like, there's even quotes that this is an issue. Like, it even said, the people he's quoting even say this is an issue. So it's kind of like, okay, wait a minute. On the one hand, you're saying they're not going to ban open source software, but then you get to the bottom of the article and it's like, well, wait a minute. Even the people you're quoting are saying that this is a major issue. Hello.
Yeah. I mean, the quote, if you can believe the quote, because it attributes a quote to the commission, not to any particular spokesman or individual, you know, to paraphrase, says, yeah, we're fine with DDWRT, as long as it can't modify the parameters of the radio.
So actually, this is interesting. Actually, a point to bring up. So there's nothing to say that somebody couldn't ship a router with DDWRT and get it certified. It just would only be able to run, you know, that particular version. It's not. Yeah, I mean, it gets complicated very quickly. So, you know, in theory, the FCC is sort of, or that statement is sort of right. Yeah, they don't ban, they're not really banning open source software, but in practice, there's actually a number of issues with that if you did try and get it certified. So let's say the device is certified and it's running DDWRT. Well, it's actually really complicated, because there's actually DDWRT, it might already be violating licenses, but there's a lot of companies that are violating licenses as well. I should also point out, all over the place. But some of these licenses actually, especially more modern licenses, like the GPL version 3 as an example, they prohibit something called TiVoization. And TiVoization basically is when you lock down a device. It might be running, you know, free software. Bob has pointed something out to me that was very interesting too. Certification is apparently $50,000. I don't Are you sure?
Well, each time it's $10,000.
I could have sworn that certification wasn't that expensive. I'm not 100% sure that's right. But Bob is saying it
application
is
fees and other each time you have to submit an application.
Do you want to come over here and say it?
No, I don't.
Okay. I guess basically he's saying it's something to the effect of it's not just the certification, but it's the overall cost for one router. I wasn't aware of that. When I've looked into it, it was like maybe, you know, set 5 to 10,000, but that wasn't everything as far as for the devices that we were specifically talking about. Anyway, now I lost my train of thought.
Well, I thought when this first came out a year ago, I bought a Buffalo router that was supposed to have DDWRT as the operating system by default. And what I got was like, are you dumber than a third grader interface? And I said, what is this? Because I've had Buffalo routers before with DDWRT and, you know, and had been very impressed with them. I was thinking, and when this came, you know, when this came to light, these new FCC regulations, I thought, oh, okay, that must what happened between the listing on Newegg and me getting the router. This has happened.
I don't know. I don't know if that's actually what happened or not. So the rule, I guess the rules were passed last year and they're coming into effect now. So I don't know. Maybe it was a reaction. Maybe it was a reaction in preparation for the rule changes. I do believe, though, that Newegg has advertised routers as supporting DDWRT, not coming with DDWRT. So those routers presumably you won't be able to flash DDWRT on them anymore, because they're not certified with DDWRT. They're certified with some other firmware, and users are just able to, or were able to, flash them with DDWRT. There are routers that are shipping with DDWRT from smaller companies. I know there's a couple companies in the, or I know, well, I was looking at one company in the UK, for example. This is something else to point out if any of your listeners are listening around the world. These rules are not just going to affect U.S. customers and people in the U.S. They're actually similar rules proposed or going to be proposed in Canada and Europe as well. So this is a worldwide issue. Chances are, and even if you weren't, even if those that wasn't the case, the rules that are being required in the U.S. are likely to affect people outside the U.S. Because when a company does something and they implement, you know, locks and things, why would they not implement locks elsewhere? They often have an incentive to do so, as it even without the rules. So there's a good chance like companies will already start implementing locks in routers, even in other devices, even if they don't have to. You know, in other countries where they sell those a product with a similar firmware, and you have to understand too, like a lot of the software that like firmwares that are actually shipped by manufacturers are based on a lot of the same underlying code. So it's not even, so if like one company implements the capability to lock a device, for example, well, that code ends up often ends up in other basically like, I kind of want to say like a stock firmware, and then it's used by other, I'm sorry, not stock firmware, but like a generic firmware, and that ends up getting used by other companies. So it becomes just a flip of a switch. It becomes very easy to start doing stuff that, you know, the company maybe not didn't really have an incentive, or maybe they just didn't have they weren't going to go out of their way to lock the device, but now that they can, they're going to. It's basically what it comes down to. They don't want their customers flashing third-party firmwares because you potentially, for example, will brick the device, and that'll increase you know, support costs and everything else. And so they'll just lock the device for that reason. And that's just a good example of why one might do it. Not everybody's going to do it. If they're advertising, you know, DDWRT, for example, or Liberty CMC or OpenWRT or any of these third-party firmwares, they might not you know, they might not have that interest in Europe right now. So maybe they will leave it unlocked. But it will certainly reduce the number of routers that you can flash, even if it weren't, even if similar rules weren't going to come into effect in other parts of the world. But again, they are there. We already know there's, we already have, I'm not even quite sure how to phrase this, but basically, we have, it's hard for me to put this in words, because there's a set of, I want to say legislation. We're just going to use that term just because it's easy for people to understand, and for me to use that term. But basically, there's already legislation that we can refer to that you can actually, look into. I can't quote it on the air here, but you can go to savewifi.org. You might be able to find it on our wiki. If you can't, you can definitely find it in the mailing list archive. So you can actually go and find the Canadian basically equivalent regulation, and you can go and find the European equivalent regulation. I believe one of these days that passed or coming up real soon is basically there's a physical police where they're going to hold a meeting of some kind. And I know one of the people on the Save Wi-Fi mailing list is going to be in attendance at that meeting. I don't believe anybody else responded saying they were also going to be at that meeting. But my understanding is that some of these topics are going to be discussed. It's not just specifically to these rules, but that we're referring, but a lot of other issues as well. During that meeting, I guess they're going to be discussing some of this. So it's not something that's, you know, oh, we don't know if it's coming or it might come, or speculating. This is stuff we know is coming, because it's already, you know, it's already public knowledge if you look into it further. We're not actually right now.
My understanding, yeah. Chris, from reading all these. Well, my understanding, Chris, from reading all these articles is pretty much anytime RSCC passes a new rule, pretty much Canada and Europe, you know, just mirror whatever it is, and oftentimes Asia, and like we've discussed, nobody's gonna build one router for the United States and one router for Asia, you know. So this could be something, you know, maybe if can't, you know, if we block the FCC from getting this done, you know, the Canadian version says no, we think this would be a good idea, and then we're gonna, you know, the companies aren't going to build different routers for different areas.
Yeah, this is kind of what I like to bring up. This is not something that, you know, this is not going to end if we get these rules. The rural proposals that are currently the proposed rules, if we are successful in curtailing them and they do not go through, the parts of these rules anyway that we're concerned about, and these parts do not go through, we're still going to have to go back and get rules that have already passed and impacting us now overturned. So this is only going to be a stage one. You know, the next month is just going to be, you know, the next couple of months is just going to be stage one of a much larger campaign. We're gonna have to, you know, campaign in Canada. We're gonna have to pay campaign in Europe. We're gonna have to go back and campaign to overturn the rules that are already passed. This is a significant issue, and we missed it. The community has missed it. It went over everybody's head, and nobody seemed to realize the significance of it. You know, a year ago, I guess, or I don't want to say a year ago. I'm not exactly sure what the time frame was when they passed the rules. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a year ago, but my understanding is it was last year that the rules were, I guess, basically being proposed and, you know, passed, and now they're going into effect. The first set of rules that I'm talking about, I'm referring to. And again, if anybody has any questions, more specific questions about the details, the technical, especially the technical or legal stuff, that needs a better explanation of anything that we're discussing, there is a mailing list. You can ask, and there's people, there's lawyers on the mailing list. There's there's software developers who are specifically develop firmware for these software-defined radios that that are at the heart of the FCC rules, you can actually go on the mailing list and you can get much better, clearer, or even just go through the archive and get better answers to these questions. And if you're involved in any kind of product development, or downstream in particular, that's definitely a place that I would encourage people to go and get on, because we're organizing, and the more impacted parties, especially people who have a financial interest in it, that we have, who are working on, refining the letters to the FCC and providing more details and more examples, on and more statistics on how this is going to affect, affect everybody, the better, because that's and that's actually one of the things that's going to be more convincing to the FCC to get them to curtail what the proposed rules. Really anything else. There's all sorts of products you might, there's all sorts of products you can find. One of the ones I always, I was using for a little while when I was talking about these issues was VPN, routers, VPN, or let me rephrase this, routers that ship with, VPN software to enable people, to have a more private internet access experience, for example. I'll give you an example. So in the UK and in Australia and a lot of countries in Europe, they have censorship. They have it. Some of it, people will justify. Some of it, people won't. They're just like, nah, this is overboard censorship. But nonetheless, these countries have censorship, and a lot of people don't realize it, but they do. And they use these routers, and they'll buy these routers, and they'll connect to a server in the United States, or they'll connect to a server in Canada, and they'll get around a lot of that censorship. But these routers, with these new rules, would these companies wouldn't be able to, they wouldn't be able to ship this product anymore. It's very important that you understand that this is not really, one product or one project that's going to be affected. It's going to be everybody. It's going to be everywhere. It's going to affect. It's going to affect everybody. Another good example is with Android phones. Right now, I want to reiterate, the phones are probably a more interesting topic to kind of go into, because the phones, they have separate chips for the modems, basically, and so you can flash them without a problem. The main part of it, anyway. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the Wi-Fi. Now that the Wi-Fi is also going to be affected, that the Wi-Fi is in a separate chip. It may be part of the SoC, and it probably is. It's speculation on my part. I just want to make that clear, because I don't actually know. I haven't been involved. I've only paid a little bit of attention to what's going on with Replicant and CyanogenMod and similar and phone firmware and so on. So I don't actually know it for a fact that the Wi-Fi's are usually on the SoC, which are going to the phones, but that is often the case with many types of ARM devices. But with these new rules, it could be that they have to lock the phones down, which humorously a lot of these companies are already doing without these rules, but it could force companies to lock the firmwares down, the core firmwares, like, so you couldn't flash CyanogenMod or Replicant or so on. There's a lot of examples out there. We already I should point out, like, there's already lots of problems with the modem firmware on like cell phones and similar types of devices that aren't being fixed, and security issues. The impact is going to be much bigger, and it's going to affect a lot more people. We can give specific, you know, smaller examples, and in certain areas I can't go into as much detail, but I can. There is one good one I can use for the Android phones, actually, that is a perfect example of what we won't be able to fix if these rules come into effect. So for those who are familiar or aren't familiar with the Replicant project, Replicant is basically a free version of Android. They basically rip out all the proprietary bits, because Android isn't really free. It's not free software. It's got a free, you know, kernel maybe, and it's got some free underlying bits, but a lot of the stuff that runs on top that ships with it, totally non-free. The Replicant version doesn't have those bits. And when Replicant removed these bits, this was a long time ago, they didn't know that they were removing spyware, but it became known more recently, probably within the last year or two, that all Android phones were shipping with this spyware. And the only reason Replicant wasn't shipping with this spyware was because it had removed this non-free piece. So, you know, having access to the sources is very important. Not having devices locked down is very important. We need to be concerned about these types of proposals. We need to keep our eyes out there. We don't know what, you know, there's all sorts of different interests that want to take away control of one's device from the user. And if we don't send in our comments to the FCC, if we don't protest these issues, we're not going to be able to do the things that we've taken for granted for all these years. And it's already getting worse as far as, firmwares go. It used to be, we could get companies to, you know, release source code for, some of the Wi-Fi firmwares, for example. But, you know, with this latest generation, not so much. There's nobody in these companies cooperating. And, with the new rules, they won't even be able to cooperate, even if they want to. And in other cases, there's with the signature checking and the locking, the companies are already doing it. NVIDIA is a perfect example on their. So there's free firmware for and NVIDIA free drivers and free firmware for NVIDIA older NVIDIA graphics chips. The project is an Novo project, and they have the ability to reverse engineer and produce a free driver, basically, for these older NVIDIA graphics cards. If you look at the newer NVIDIA graphics cards, you'll notice that they're not supported. And the reason they're not supported is because NVIDIA is locking the firmware. They're checking the signature. Their firmware is signed, and they're checking to make sure that the firmware that you try to load is also signed by them. And if it's not, you won't be able to do it. So, you know, so we're seeing these locks all over the place already, and it has nothing to do with FCC. These are companies doing it out of their own interests. You can see this with Intel. NVIDIA and Intel are the two examples that I'm much more familiar with. But I'm sure there's lots of other great examples. Trying to get some more examples, but I'm not having much luck here from the other developer who is with me at the moment, who works on some of this stuff. So, all right, I'm going to give people the website again. It's www.savewifi.org. We're looking for people to send in comments to the FCC. The FCC is basically trying to ban third-party software, so they're basically they're trying to get manufacturers to lock devices down, so you might not be able to install your favorite distribution, it's very clear with the routers and the firmware, because they've actually explicitly given examples of how they're asking manufacturers how they are going to prevent the loading of third-party firmware. So in other words, you wouldn't be able to load DDWRT, OpenWRT, LibreryCMC at all with these rules that they're proposing and or already in effect. And a lot of routers we've already seen, we've already seen the firmware locks coming shipping with firmware locks now. So it's very important that people write to the FCC and tell the FCC how these locks are going to negatively impact either their usage and what they do, and any statistics you might have, cite the statistics, give examples, because those are the most valuable comments as far as the getting the FCC to not pursue these particular proposed rules. Again, the site is www.savewifi.org, and I'm gonna point out that the name of the campaign is actually quite misleading in the sense that it's not really about Wi-Fi. It's about having control over our devices, and it's not just going to affect the Wi-Fi chip. It's going to affect everything, because the way manufacturers are going to solve this problem, the certification problem, is by implementing the quickest and easiest method of complying with the rules, and that is the practical implications of those rules are the problem. It's not necessarily that it can't be done some other way. It's just not going to be, and there's no. The FCC itself has stated. And it is assumed that much in the very questions that are being asked of manufacturers during the certification process. And I'm gonna repeat this for if anybody's just I'm not sure exactly how this is being broadcast or people are listening in on it, but if you're just tuning in now, basically, they've asked the question of, how are you going to prevent the loading of third-party firmware? And they gave an example, DDWRT. So it's not just DDWRT, it's LibreryCMC, which is 100% free firmware, by the way. OpenWRT, any of these, what are some of the other ones? Tomato, not Tomato. Well, there's others, I can't quote them off the top of my head at the moment. But any of these third-party firmwares, you're not gonna be able to load on these devices anymore.
Yeah, to clarify, Chris, Hacker Public Radio is a podcast that is broadcast there's a new episode on the site every weekday, 5 days a week. Right now we're looking at a 14-day backlog, but if I get the show edited tonight, I'm going to ask the administrator to let me put in like a public service announcement and add it for to get people aware of this situation, and once it's uploaded, people will be able to access it ahead of time if they want to.
Okay.
There's no feed going out tonight like else has, but it'll definitely get on the schedule within the next 2 weeks.
Gotcha.
And like I said, I'm hoping we can add a PSA where people can jump to it early.
Great. Is it so I wasn't entirely sure if it was I realized it wasn't being aired tonight, but is it actually aired like on the radio, or is it just purely a podcast? That's what I wasn't 100% sure of.
No, it's purely a podcast. You go to hackerpublicradio.org. Okay. And there's a feed, of course, or you can download them. Like I said, if you want to download episodes ahead of time, click on the Give Shows link, and then there's a calendar, and you go to the calendar, and any show that's been uploaded into the calendar, you can go ahead and grab.
All right, so I probably don't need to repeat myself so much. That's good to know.
Now, the one last thing I wanted to interject. Looks like my Wi-Fi is pretty, or not my Wi-Fi, my mobile is pretty good right now. Surely the FCC is not so foolish to understand that, okay, yeah, they could probably do away with, or try to do away with Linux on the desktop, and it would, you know, it would affect a minuscule amount of desktop users, though those that it did would be angry like a hornet's nest. But you know, on the server side, you know, if they did something to make it so open source couldn't be used on the server side, they'd immediately take down more than half of the servers on the web and half, you know, half or more of servers running, including their own, because including the show notes, there's a CURL command you can run to see what a site is using as their web server, and the site that is asking for comments is actually running Nginx.
This doesn't really surprise me. It'll be very
instructive when they come. I guess they have come back now, that if it says it's IIS.
Yeah, you have to understand that a lot of this stuff, that a lot of legislation that passes is really, there's already like legislation and rules and things. There's already plenty of legislation and rules to do the job, those who are in charge to do the job that they're in charge of doing. And what it is they're basically trying to get more legislation passed so that they can basically, you know, do things like throw books at people. And just because you know, they can get you for one thing doesn't mean if they pass additional legislation now they can get you for others. Or maybe they're not really going to use this the legislation or the rules against everybody, but they'll use it selectively. Maybe they don't want maybe they don't want Google coming out with an Android phone, so they'll selectively use it against Google. They like Apple, so they'll go ahead and they'll let Apple get a free ride, and Apple will get away with lots of stuff that Google won't be able to get away with, because they're using it selectively. I don't want to suggest that that's the intent here. I don't know. It's really hard to believe that. It just seems so, the extent of how this could affect us, it's just so extreme. It's not logical. It's just not. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. The significant of the impact, if it was taken and if it was enforced as fully as it could be, it would take down everything. I mean, it would just be so astronomical as far as the implication and the negative implication and how I really can't even see. I suspect that they're not going to, they can't possibly enforce the rules everywhere on everybody, because if they did, it just isn't going to work. I mean, you understand that a lot of this stuff is the code. They don't have, there isn't a closed version of the code. It's all free software. And if there isn't a closed version of it to begin with, how do you close something that is, maybe hundreds of different parties have a part of ownership of the copyright to? You have to get them all to agree to re-license their code under some sort of proprietary license. Like, I mean, the whole idea that this will work is just mind-numbing. Like, it isn't going to work. There's no way it's going to work. Maybe we could even ignore this issue and it'll go away on its own, simply because of the amount of collateral damage will take us down. I mean, it'll take everything down. But we can't risk that either. Because if they selectively enforce it, they could selectively enforce it so they take out all the little guys, and then maybe you won't be able to get routers with VPN software on them anymore. Or maybe they'll use it maybe they'll use it so that they can insert back doors. Again, I don't know. I don't know what their intent was. Nobody seems to know their intent. It's been speculation. They've used double talk, you know, to clarify and basically deny it. But it's very clear. They've asked questions that explicitly, you know, again, they asked the questions such that the only way a manufacturer can even respond is to say, oh, we locked down and we implemented signature checking. If that's the only answer, if that's the only answer you can give to get certified, clearly there's a problem here. Even if you can make the claim that the intent is not to lock everything down, it doesn't really matter, because that's the implication. That's what's going to happen. Just based on, you know, the questions that are being asked as part of the certification process, and the rules as they are and how they can be enforced. You're not going to risk, you know, a $20,000, you know, per device fine. you're not going to test that in court. Nobody's going to test that in court. It's not how it's going to go down. Everybody's just going to lock their devices down. It's just that simple.
And it's not going to do them any good, because good luck telling places like Alibaba that they can't sell a $30 SDR and send it straight to your door.
Yeah, no, they're not going to be able to. They're not going to be able to with the way the current rules are. It doesn't say it has to be a hardware lock. It doesn't specify any kind of locking at all. It's the effects of this. It could be that the FCC though could decline. They could maybe decline if somebody says it. See, here's the thing. You might reply saying, oh, we implemented signature checking in software, right? But the FCC could come back and say, well, that's not good enough. Well, now what? You have to implement hardware locking? If you implement hardware locking, then you're not even going to be able to, the end user is not going to, or any downstream user for that matter, or a party, or a reseller, or a retailer, or a value-added, you know, reseller, which is all, most of them, really. They're not going to be able to, they're not going to be able to do this. This can't happen. This can't happen. We got to stop it. So go to www.savewifi.com. Send the FCC comments.
Well, the only thing we can really hope for, the FCC has the brains and they have the balls to go to these hardware manufacturers and say, no, this, you know, software locking isn't good enough. This is not what we intended. What you are going to have to do is only use a radio that in hardware can only do the legal parameters, or, you know, have it sandboxed at such a point where it doesn't matter what firmware or operating system you put on the system. Because, I mean, let's face it, the FCC is, like I said earlier, they're very black and white. They don't deal in gray. I mean, if there's one way to make a radio do something they don't like, then they're going to legislate that no matter how many people they destroy or inconvenience.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting because they've come out in the past. Their response is much different now than what has been their response, I noticed, in the past in regards to similar types of issues. So one of the things that the FCC has come out and said when manufacturer. So one of the things many, many, many years ago, Lenovo, actually I believe it was IBM at the time, came out and they started implementing a locking of the Wi-Fi card, the whitelisting, basically. And basically whitelisting is just, it says, okay, if it's this card, yeah, go ahead and boot the system. If it's any other card, don't boot the system. And they were implementing this. So basically what it did is it prevented users from swapping out Wi-Fi cards with, you know, a different Wi-Fi card, or, you know, buying any other Wi-Fi card than the one that you get from IBM, basically. And the FCC, and nobody else at the time was doing this, But over the years, slowly, over the last several years, all the major manufacturers basically started doing it, most of them anyway. We now have Dell, Lenovo, Toshiba, Apple, Sony, HP, if I didn't mention HP. There's a good six or seven of them now that are locking Wi-Fi cards down on laptops already. So you can't switch the Wi-Fi card. So it was interesting because the FCC came out and said that this isn't required. And there's no such requirement. But that was the excuse that was originally given by IBM at the time. And it's interesting. If you actually look at manufacturers, you can still get, there's tons of laptops you can get from other manufacturers that don't have this whitelisting or these locks in their systems. So I do tend to believe that, you know, the FCC didn't at the time require it. And it was a financial interest in it because, well, something is very clear about why a company would go ahead and do that. And again, it's because a good portion of most of the profits that come from selling laptops and desktops and things like that don't come from selling the desktop or the laptop. There's low margins on that. What they make the money off of is all the accessories, the warranties, the services that you buy along with those products. That's where they make the money. So to see a company like, you know, Lenovo or IBM or HP or any of these companies lock the hardware, it does seem more reasonable to me that the reason that they had started doing it was because it was financially interested in doing so. They have come out and they have said stuff like, oh well, it's not the FCC, it's they think they quoted the FCC, or no, not quoted, but they I think what they originally did was they referred to the FCC as banning it, but then they came out later and been like, after people, you know, after the FCC came out and said, oh no, we don't require this, I think they came out with another statement, something to the effect of, oh well, the FCC doesn't require it maybe, but we have to do it because other countries require it, or something to that effect, which was really, actually thinking about this back now, was really kind of silly, because just because you sell a laptop in, you know, another country, the rules that you have to comply with are for the U.S. So they're not required to lock down the Wi-Fi cards for the U.S. They're required to lock down the Wi-Fi cards for that other country. So the whole idea, like their whole response, was really like, didn't really make a whole heck of a lot of sense. But again, the original response didn't really make a whole lot of sense either, because it was obvious, it was plain as day that nobody else was doing it at the time. And even now, there's lots of companies. All these years later, if this was something, if the FCC really was forcing it, you would have seen it across the board. You wouldn't have seen it, you know, just with IBM or just with a handful of manufacturers. Everybody would have been complying, because the FCC, if the FCC comes down on you, they're going to, and maybe initially they might not be harsh on you, like really hard on you with a $20,000 per device fine or a computer fine. But, you know, if you continue to violate and you disobey them, they will come down really, really harsh on you. If you're a small player, you're probably out of business. Everybody's going to comply.
Yeah, and in the interest of disclosure, you know, as far as buying my hardware for Linux, I'm one of those cheap SOBs who buys, you know, used 4 or 6-year-old hardware rather than going on Think Penguin or something. But having talked to you and seen your support for our cause, you know, maybe the next time around I'm in looking for hardware, I'm going to have to seriously consider, well, maybe I ought to show a little loyalty.
Actually kind of interesting. I definitely encourage people to buy from companies that are, supporting free software. There's really only probably two companies I can recommend, one being ThinkPenguin and the other being MiniFree. MiniFree is a company in the UK that basically has done a lot of work on LibreBoot, which is 100% free BIOS. It's basically Core Boot, but without the non-free pieces. And they're the other company that I would encourage people to buy from. And if you don't like new hardware, they're actually a really good source for source to go to, because they're actually refurbished Lenovos, which, you know, normally you'd say, oh, wait a minute, that's not a good thing. But the reason they're using them, there's a reason they do refurbished Lenovos, and it's because you can't free a newer laptop than the ones they're freeing. So they have to go and use something. They have to basically free laptops that are older and also have enough sources for basically the parts. So because the older hardware, they don't have the digital signatures and hardware locks on like they do with the newer hardware. So like with ThinkPenguin laptops, our laptops do not have a free BIOS. Everything else is free, so you can run 100% free OS. But as far as the BIOS, it's not free, unfortunately. And this is one of the things that we're also trying to get away from. But it's a very, very big issue. Going back to what you were saying and how important it is to support. So right now we're not making really any money off of the routers, which is Liberty CMC is a very important project. And one of the reasons we sell a router is because we need to fund these types of projects. And there was a distribution prior called Liberty WRT, and Liberty WRT, Bob, who's the lead developer at Liberty CMC, actually started that it was several years ago. You know what? I can't actually tell you the date exactly, but it was for a Buffalo router, actually, as one of the routers. It might even be one of the routers you bought. It wasn't actually 100% free. The router, there was non-free BIOS. I'm sorry, not non-free BIOS, non-free bootloader. And they actually thought it was. I guess they were under the impression it was completely free, and then they realized years later that it wasn't. But because of the non-free bootloader, but everything else was free. And but that project, he left that project for because of differences in the direction it was going. One of the other problems that happens is that you get in situations where the developers who are working on these projects, they're not making any money off it. And it becomes very difficult to hold down a full-time job and work on these side projects. And especially when you're not being paid, paid what you're worth. And that happens a lot, especially with people who are really, really concerned about these types of issues, because they just tend not to have the personalities that they're going to go to their boss and say, hey, you're not paying me enough. So you end up with these situations where these people who they just don't have time to work on these projects. If they were even getting paid, $30,000 a year, which is nothing in, a first world country, they would work on these projects full time, despite the fact that, if they work for the industry, might be making $100,000 a year. And that's kind of what's going on with Liberty CMC, really. Liberty CMC was stifled by the lack of funds. Bob had to work, he had to have a job, he didn't really have the time to work on Liberty CMC. It wasn't until about a year ago that we started funding that, and he actually really got it off the ground. The amount of money that's coming in versus what we're spending is it doesn't even come close to cover costs. So yeah, I mean, trying to support these companies are any company again that's really doing real work on some of these types of projects is important. And then, like I said, I would encourage people to take a look at Mini Free. I'm not entirely sure of the URL for that, but if you go to fsf.org/ryf. You can find it. It's one of the products that the Free Software Foundation certifies as being completely free. We also have a few items on that list. Most of our products could probably be certified, actually, but they're not, because it takes time and resources and energy to get stuff certified and go through it in debt and make sure everything is in fact free. But we've done it for three different USB dongles and a router so far. We already know that other Other devices would also certify, but all that kind of stuff is time consuming, and there's most of these companies are not big companies. You know, there's a handful of employees at best, if that. So I should also point out that you can also contribute to a lot of these projects will have donation pages for donations and or like memberships, and they also use that for fundraising. So like, for example, Triskel is a good example. It's 100% free distribution, and they don't, again, none of you won't be making much. You have to understand that even if you get a lot of people donating, you know, $10 a month, it generally won't, because the projects are just not big enough. It really doesn't raise enough funds to even keep one full-time developer working on the projects. So it is important to try and fund some of these projects. We can fund some of them, but we can't fund, you know, most of them. We can fund maybe one or two projects at a time, maybe three projects nowadays, but yeah, I mean, we're funding LibreCMC, and we're funding one other project I can't really talk about at the moment, but it involves laptops and freeing stuff in relation to it. So yeah, that's what I have to say about that.
Well, on Hacker Public Radio this past summer, we have been highlighting some of these projects. I think one of them was GPG, but you know, there were other projects pretty much run by one person and are critical to not only open source software, but proprietary, you know, been adopted by proprietary software all over the place. And it's one guy, and he's not really getting paid for what he's doing. And about ready to get, you know, give up the ghost and say, somebody else needs to do this. I'm not going to do it anymore for no money. There's one in particular, and if I hadn't had beers tonight, I probably could remember which one it was. But if anybody's interested, they can scan back on the episode since the first of the year of Hacker Public Radio, and you'll be, it'll stand out. But yeah, there is so much stuff that we all depend upon, and it's one guy who's not getting paid to do it.
Yeah, a lot of these projects don't have a public face to them. They're being included by, like, you know, distributions, but they're not. There's not a public website where you're going to it and downloading that particular component. So you don't even know. And a lot of these people who are working on these projects, they're not even, like, they're not making a stink about it. They're not going out there and be like, hey, I can't afford to do this anymore. You know, I got kids to feed. I got mouths to feed. I got rent to pay. You know, they're not coming out and they're not saying this. And I kind of wish they would. And they're going to get, I understand why a lot of these people are not doing that, and it comes down to the fact that they get a lot of backlash. Anybody who you have to be, when projects do this kind of stuff and they do come out and say, hey, we need money, you know, lots of times they get backlash for it. I'm disgruntled, but that's not quite the right word. I get so frustrated by, you know, people when, you know, they criticize people for, you know, requesting money, and they don't understand that it's free software is not about, it's not about the money. It's not about the cost. It's about the difference between gratis and libre. Gratis means cost, basically, and it's with, so in other words, it's with, so you'd be saying it's without cost, basically. That's not what free software is about. Free software is about the liberty aspect of it, or libre. Libre is basically means liberty, and it means that you have control. It means you have access to the source code. It means you can make changes to the source code. You can build the source code. Other people can do it. You can redistribute those changes. And just, there's so many people out there who just don't get it, or they're maybe shills. They might be. I honestly think that a lot of them are just shills for other companies who have an interest in undermining these projects. Unfortunately, because there's just so many of them, it's hard to believe. And most of the people I talk to have the exact opposite. You know, they say the exact or how do I say this? They're basically the exact opposite. They say, how can we help more? What can we do? And it's like, I don't know, other than, you know, financially contributing, I don't know how you can help. So it kind of takes me aback when I see comments and, you know, that are, or downvoted or upvoted or, you know, negative, towards, you know, some of these projects, because it just, I know that there's so much more we should all be doing, and there's not, I can't do enough. I really can't. I'm subscribed to so many different projects and organizations for funding, not large amounts, just small amounts, like $10 here, $10 there. And I know it's not doing a whole heck of a lot of good, because there's just so many of them. And most of them that probably, you know, are more, even more important, aren't getting any funds, because they don't have a public website. They're it's some library somewhere that somebody, you know, maintains. Maybe it's the time, you know, or the date, for example. That might be a good example. It's just somebody updating, keeping a database up to date with all the different time zone changes and things like that. Or maybe it's, you know, the security, the, what was it? OpenSSL, was it? It might have been something else, but that was another. There was another good one directly relating to security, and they're just, you know, the person didn't have the time and energy, and they couldn't do it. And I think they actually got funding eventually from I think it was the Linux Foundation, if I remember correctly. After getting a lot of publicity, I think they did raise a bunch of money for like a year or two worth of funding, and then I think they did eventually attract the Linux Foundation to fund them. But I'm not entirely sure if there was a limit to how long it was going to be funded. So, you know, there certainly could have been. So yeah, these are important issues and funding. I mean, that in and of itself could be a whole show. Just talking about, you know, the different projects that are poorly and are not funded, or poorly or not funded at all. Because there's I've had this discussion with a lot of different developers. I'm working on very important pieces, and you know, I think one project, for example, had something like $8,000 that they raised ever in the entire life of the project, and it had been around for 10 years. $8,000, that's nothing. So, you know, that probably won't even feed me for a year. I mean, let alone, you know, pay rent and, you know, other expenses and insurance and things like that. So, yep. Yeah. We need to think about these developers and try and fund them and try and support companies who are funding them, because, there's not a whole heck of a lot of them. There's like one or two other companies that, you also might want to look at, fsf.org/ryf that are also doing quite a bit, to support this kind of thing. Can't think of them off the top of my head at the moment, but MiniFree comes to mind because they're the developer behind it is behind their laptops is or the freeing those laptops is the LibreBoot, the key LibreBoot developer, and it's pretty much, I believe it's pretty much a one man show there as far as that goes. And there's the CoreBoot. There's actually also a CoreBoot developer, and actually it's really that's actually a really sad situation, because there's another company that's basically undermined MiniFree and the developer behind LibreBoot, and he's made a bunch of false statements as far as you know, cooperation with LibreBoot and so forth. And trying to free modern laptops, which just isn't possible. So yeah, it's you gotta be really careful. There's a lot of malicious, a lot of people out there who are trying to take advantage of basically the goodwill of the masses. And there was another, I don't know if you remember, there was another one here not that long ago. I think they were trying to do a Tor project, like build a router with Tor on it, but it basically was just off the shelf components. And I don't know if it kind of just grew out of hand. Originally it might have gotten a little bit too much criticism, because I don't know that the original intent was actually to, you know, you know, deceive people. But ultimately what happened was I think they raised like 200 something plus $1,000, and I think they were only asking for like 7,000, but the way they worded the their fundraiser was something to the effect that we're designing such and such, and they really weren't designing the hardware aspect. They were working on the software aspect, and then there was other problems where they actually were kind of they gave it the impression that it was going to make all your traffic anonymous, and that's not really possible. There was multiple angles. They could have been putting people at risk actually with the product, unless they were very clear about what it could and couldn't do. And I guess they really weren't doing that. These are the kinds of things you really got to watch out for, especially with fundraisers and things like that. There are a lot of people who are working on projects and they're not running fundraisers. The people who are running are a lot of times running the fundraisers are people who are just taking advantage. They're lying about what they're doing or not doing or able to do, and it's sad because there are a lot of good people out there who are doing a lot of good work. Some of these people are not even they're not even necessarily developers, but I'm thinking of one person in particular. But that works for a nonprofit organization. But he does so much work, and he's been around so long, and he's in a job that it doesn't pay well. You have to understand that he could go out and work for industry, but he's doing good work for he doesn't have to be, but he really cares about the cause that he's fighting for. There's a lot of people like that, and they don't get the recognition that they deserve. We tend to pick out people once a year to give them recognition, and that's not enough. There's so many other people out there, and it's hard to see it, because I see it. I work with a lot of these people, and they're never going to get recognition. They're never going to make any money off it. So yeah, if you can contribute to projects that are that have the have pages that say, hey, support me, they're free software type projects. Like, again, I like Trisco as a perfect example, I think, because they're producing a completely free distribution, and they haven't pulled in much, but you can go to their page and see how much money they brought in, I believe. And I think you have to add it up, but nonetheless, Ruben has actually made a statement to the effect of how much money they raised, and the life of the project, that project hasn't been nearly enough. And we're actually that's one of the projects also that we're contributing to financially. It doesn't bring them in much money, but it does bring them a little bit of money. Actually, if you want to contribute to that project, and you're buying hardware from us, go to libri.thinkpenguin.com, because we donate 25% of the profits from all sales if you do that to that project specifically. So
yeah, I think probably I'd buy from you, but I would say contribute this to this project, but I want my computer to come blank, and I'll decide what distribution I want to put on it.
Yeah, I mean, again, you don't have to go and buy from Think Penguin or anything like that. I'm not suggesting that. You can go out and you can become a member of the Trisco project or some other project. Again, there's lots of projects out there that do have some sort of you can go and directly fund them. Not everybody, but there's a number of them out there. Most of them have some sort of front page, like they're like a distribution or something, or whatnot. Unfortunately, it's usually the distributions actually probably that are doing that more than anybody else, and they're not necessarily doing the real core development, unfortunately. There are actually a few exceptions there. I'm actually not going to name some of the other distributions, just because they're doing good work, but I don't want to promote them just because some of their policies are not proper on the air here on the radio station. So there's a mix basically between you're doing everything right and you're not doing everything right, and the particular project I'm thinking of has got more money than they know what to do with, so it's perfectly fine to leave them out of recommendations. Okay, www.savewifi.org. I don't know how long this show is, so if we're way over the time or anything, maybe we should wrap it up.
Well, there's no set time, but we're pushing 3 hours.
Yeah. Okay.
Listen, folks, if you have not heard of this issue before, you may have heard of some podcasts saying, well, we won't be able to do open source on consumer routing hardware anymore. This potentially can go a lot farther than that. It may ban us from open source altogether. And I think this may well be the most important podcast. If you're not familiar with this issue, this may be the most important podcast you've listened to all year.
Yeah.
Thank Chris Wade from Think Penguin and Save Wi-Fi. And I agree with you. It's not so much Save Wi-Fi, it's Save Open Source.
Yeah, it's absolutely. It's very misleading. But it was catchy, and we actually I think when we picked the name, we actually didn't fully comprehend the extent of the problem. So
I've been your host, 150, and if you want please leave comments in the comment area on the show page, or contact me directly at 5150@linuxbasement.com. And I think Chris has made abundantly clear how you can contact the Save Wi-Fi movement.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.